Welcome everybody, and also welcome the online people. We're on the third class of this course, Becoming Your Best Self. So how to become a good human being, how to become a happy human being, how to have natural confidence, and how to really make the very, very most of our life. And, you know, in the last year, with all of the anxiety and scare of COVID, many of us felt our life slipping through our fingers, you know, of just being locked at home. What can we do? And time is ticking, and really made us aware of how important it is to be able to take the essence of this life. So each of the classes that we're doing is a kind of a standalone topic. So I'll get the screen share up for what we've already covered in the first two classes. We looked at the three types of happiness identified by the Buddha, because we all want to be happy. It's not through lack of trying, and yet we do go up and down, don't we? So what are the things that are stopping us, and also what are we focusing on? And what we found was that most of the time we focus on hedonic happiness, meaning just stuff in our immediate vicinity, being distracted by everything that comes in through the senses, or completely overwhelmed by everything that comes in through the senses. And that distracts us from looking within and from actually flourishing. And that was one of the hidden benefits of COVID and a lockdown, wasn't it? That we got the time to just sit with ourselves and learn to sit with ourselves without it being civil war inside, and actually start reflecting and developing some, you know, becoming aware of those inequalities. Then we looked at last week the eight worldly concerns that distract us. So I don't know about you, but I get distracted by all eight, sometimes all eight at once. And at least I can see the distraction happening sometimes, but it really is biting the hook, that the immediate concerns and the short-term concerns just overwhelm everything. And it's really at the expense of us doing what matters to us, and often at the expense of our own values. So we also looked at the nature of attachment, biting the hook, how we get sucked into things because of those worldly concerns as well. And we looked at cognitive fusion. So we're going to look at cognitive fusion again tonight. So cognitive fusion means that we are a slave to the belief that our happiness comes from outside. So what we see as a yummy thing or a disgusting thing, we think it comes from the side of the object. And then we have all of our reactions to it. So we'll have a look at how that works again today, just because it's such a juicy topic. What I wanted to ask was, for those of you that were doing the homework sheets, the reflection sheets, did you have any questions, comments, anything that stood out to you? Anything about the eight worldly concerns that you discovered? What? How did you go? Tell me, remind me your name again.
It's Mel Gosha.
Mel Gosha. Right. All in one word. Yes. Okie dokie.
Actually one word.
Excellent. I will get it. Tell me, how did you go?
I just wanted to share that I just kind of had a really great little period where I've been working on some of my eight worldly dharmas, and I've been doing this work for a while, but this is the way that you do it. It's very practical. You know, it's like without all the Buddhism.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cut through for me more this time. And so I realized something you said last week, that it was just like a revelation. It was kind of like, oh my God, I could be having more fun. And like, I'm not letting myself, I'm not like, you said the opportunity to The fear of failure stops you having the
experiment. That's right. And the joy of experimenting.
And then also I filled in the thing of like how it might be different for me and others. And I was like, oh, I would have more fun. And then how it would be for them, oh my God, it would be so much less painful for them. You know, because they have to put up with me and all my being down on myself, because I'm willing to try and I get really down on myself, and you know, it's like, it's just like this darkness.
Yeah,
I must be so heavy, like no wonder I'm getting this bad vibe. And then that feeds into
it, feeds into it. Yeah,
or they don't like me now. And so this week I've been really trying to what's really helped is you know, like, rather than saying you can't have cheesecake, not that it's cheesecake, but it's just a, you know, analogy.
The metaphorical cheesecake.
Yeah, the metaphorical cheesecake. Rather than saying that, it's like, you know, well, you can have mud cake instead, right? Like, that's not an analogy, but basically knowing there's a higher happiness, just having that little formula in my head has been really helpful. And
so have you been able to see it happening in front of you, the process?
It's just like the last couple of days, it's just been this huge shift, and I've been like, oh, so interesting, because I'm so feared of like, you know, performance and anxiety. I'm so scared. And so I'm like, oh, no, if you do that, you're giving up this inner happiness of real reason why. And the end of this, sorry, it's been long-winded, the end of this is that then I went to this place today, like where I'm studying and doing stuff that makes me really frightened. And then it wasn't, everyone was really wonderful. Like, and yet the last time I was there, it wasn't like that. So it was almost like I changed. And even though I'm sure I didn't have an effect on that, somehow it was like magically.
No, this is what happens. Very, like, you change and the world changes.
Except that I can see the direct connection when it happens. Mm-hmm. But this is almost mystical, because there's no way I could have changed the student cohort this year.
No, but this is the thing, and actually, we're going to look at that.
Was like they were feeding off how I was feeling, because I was being so much more positive, and
because you changed. Then the whole way the world appears changes. And then we think, oh, the world must be different now. But no, that's because you changed. And so we're going to see tonight why that happens.
Yeah, but I mean, I get that, but I honestly think it really was better as well, objectively.
Like, yeah, but not out there better, in here better.
Yeah.
But that's it. And I'm sure you can all relate to that, can't you? That when we stop being so fearful about those immediate concerns and actually look to the things that we love, the things that matter to us, and that's what makes us be able to relax. Whereas normally what happens when we get really fearful, we're just starting having a fight with ourselves, isn't it? Like, don't be fearful, or be brave, or, you know, don't be anxious. And we just compound the anxiety over and over. So I used to kind of think of it, it's a sideways approach to, instead of tackling anxiety or fear head on, it's a sideways one of looking at, well, what gives me nourishment? What do I love doing? How can I contribute to the world? And then naturally we relax. Mm. So
it's like just easier. Like,
yeah.
It's not like I've got to fight it.
That's right. Yeah. Bingo. Mila, Gosha?
You can say Gosha.
Gosha. Ha ha. Excellent. Thank you very much, Gosha. Right. Who else? Yes. Yes. So we are actually going to touch on hope as well tonight, but there are different ways to look at hope. So one way is almost to do with a sense of faith or anticipation, but based in reality. So based in a conviction and an understanding of reality, and then we can have a very realistic hope. So you can hope for enlightenment, for instance, even though not many of us do, but it is grounded in reality because it is theoretically possible for all of us. But a lot of hope is just wishing things were different. And whilst we can just enjoy that kind of hope, then we think they'll turn out that way. And that's what brought Brexit along, wasn't it? You know, everyone's just told, oh, it'll be great. Everyone hoped so much for it to be great. But that's not enough. So there's a couple of different ways there. So there is one part where, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he says, never give up, no matter what, never give up. And then there's also another quote where I've heard from His Holiness where he said, abandon hope. Hope is a complete detour. So it really depends what the context is. But as with everything with Buddhism, it's grounded in reality. But reality according with, you know, our relative truth and ultimate truth, not the reality that we just assume is there. Okay. Anyway, hold that thought because we'll get to it as well. So, woohoo! I'm waiting for the bang of the lightning. Why are we here tonight? We're looking at the three higher trainings. So these are trainings of how to make our life better now. So the things we need to actually train in so we just have a good life now. So we're just happy and confident. They're skills that we aren't necessarily born with. Some of us are. Some of us have a big steep hill to climb with them, but it's something that we can learn how to do. Very liberating. But more importantly, with these trainings, they are the three things that we need to train in if we want to completely overcome suffering forever, if we want to become liberated from the ups and downs of cyclic existence, if we want to be able to help others. So, you know, for our own fulfillment, also skills for humanity, for being a good human being. You know, we might think, oh, we need to have a degree or a career or some form of status. We don't actually need any of those things. What we need is these three higher trainings, which is great because you don't have to buy them. You don't have to get a hex debt for them. So let's just do a short focus meditation. So the main thing is to straighten your spine. And one way that's very nice to do this is imagining that there is a thread of light running through the center of your body, just in front of your spine, from the base of the spine up through your body and up to the crown of your head, and feel it's just being pulled upwards from your crown. So especially if you're tired, you can feel that the weight of your body is effortlessly supported by this thread of light. And you'll notice your whole posture just naturally adjusts. So when your spine is straight, then let your shoulders drop and kind of pull the shoulders back a little bit so the chest and the heart area is open. And bring your attention to the breath, just becoming aware of the rising and falling of the breath. So you don't have to change your breathing in any way. If it's a bit ragged, if it's nice and smooth, that's okay. Just become aware of the breathing. And that way we can slowly release any other thoughts or distractions, just focusing on the breath for a moment. And we can take this opportunity, this moment of stillness, to reflect on why we're here. How come we actually put the effort into coming along tonight, to dealing with the technology and getting online? There are many people that just thought about it, but you put the effort in. So what is the driving factor that you put the effort in for? Why are you here? So that kind of motivation, a start where you are motivation. And then we can adjust that motivation to make it extensive and wonderful. No need to put any limits on it. Recognizing that we can actually achieve our own lasting happiness and we can help all others as well. We can attain liberation and enlightenment and all the wonderful skills and abilities and peacefulness all the way along. So recognizing how just putting in the time tonight can have this really extensive benefit for ourselves and others, and looking forward to that, having recognizing it as a well-grounded hope. And with this altruistic motivation in our heart, take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth, and open your eyes if they're closed. Let's have a look at what this topic is about, the three higher trainings. I actually took a little short course called The Three Higher Trainings for Dummies, because, you know, I love those dummies books, not least because they have cartoons and things in them. But I always thought the three higher trainings was just way, way too hard and difficult. But actually, it's something that we all have started on already. They're called higher because they're not the ordinary versions of it. They're higher because it's a lot more than just for a good life now. Of course, they'll help us have a good life now. But actually, the main purpose for them is to be able to achieve liberation or enlightenment. So the complete cessation of all suffering and its causes. And with these three higher trainings, then we can cut the root of suffering forever. So there's this wonderful picture here that illustrates the three higher trainings. So we've got the branch of the tree, all the different types of sufferings that are possible. And most of the time we just try and deal with each one at a time, isn't it? Something happens in the day and we try and fix another thing and we try and fix it. And then decades, years later, we're still putting out fires. So what we have, all of the suffering and the root of suffering right there. If we cultivate ethics, that is like the body of the person. So ethics is actually something that we embody. It's something we have to live. We have to walk the talk. We've all heard that, haven't we? We can't just agree with ethics. We can't just subscribe to that and go, oh, yeah, I believe this or my values are that. We actually have to embody them, don't we? And we've all seen what happens when politicians and various other people say they have one set of ethics and then clearly don't embody them at all. Like, it just doesn't count, does it? So embodying them, that's this really, it's the strength of putting it into practice. The other thing about ethics is that, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said we're in psychic existence, the ups and downs of life, because our minds are out of control. And our minds are actually under the control of all of our disturbing emotions and delusions. And then we respond kind of like that, like being on tilt, and then it colours everything that we do. And it's very difficult to control what's going on in our mind. So the easy place to start, that we definitely can start right now, is to control how we act physically and how we speak. So all of us can do that, super easy. So this, by training in ethics, it gives us a really strong foundation, and it stops us creating more trouble. It stops us making things worse. And then later, you know, bit by bit, we can deal with our mind. But just to try start dealing with our mind straight away, that's really tricky. Something nice and upfront like ethics. Then we overcome distraction by cultivating concentration. So concentration is like the two strong arms, and they hold the axe or the sword of wisdom that cuts. So I'm sure you've seen some funniest home video shows with, you know, people doing really stupid things with axes or chainsaws or whatever, where they just overestimate their strength. And, you know, you lift up the huge big axe to go boom, and it just goes backwards and over you go or whatever. So we might have quite a sharp mind. We might love analyzing things, but if we don't have concentration where we can hold our train of thought and where we can see a system of reasoning to the end, where we kind of get halfway through and we just fall off, we're like those funniest home videos. So we need to have single-pointed concentration so we can actually progress, so we can stabilize our realizations. And so when things go wrong, we remember what to do. Because I know I've been in countless Buddhist classes, but when something goes wrong, often I'll just go blank. I'm like, what do I do? What do I do? So it's having concentration that means we have the presence of mind to draw on our Dharma wisdom. And we remember to do that when it actually counts, when a problem arises. Having concentration depends on having ethics, because if we're not comfortable in our own skin, we're not going to be able to concentrate. We will be constantly distracted and uncomfortable, agitated. And we need those two, the ethics and the concentration, because we need to develop wisdom, because it's only with wisdom that we can actually cut the root of suffering. All the rest of the time, we're just putting a Band-Aid on it. You know, we might pick a leaf off here and woohoo, a leaf off there. But if we really want it, why not get rid of everything in one swoop? You know, cut it at the root. So let's have a look. I thought we'd start with the trickiest one first, training in wisdom, and then progressively get easier as we go through the night, because, you know, we're all fresh now. So a quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama: we are at the center of all of our troubles, and it is therefore best to work at understanding our true nature first. So instead of getting all kind of intellectual about and philosophical about the nature of the world, or, you know, how everything began, or all the wonderful kind of Western philosophy that we have, if we're going to train in wisdom, we've got to start by looking within our own mind, because it's us who suffers, isn't it? So just like His Holiness says, that's the place to start. He also says that love and compassion alone are not enough to directly combat all of our ignorance and confusion by themselves. So we absolutely, if we want to end suffering, we have to develop wisdom. And the type of wisdom that we need is a particular wisdom that understands reality. One way to come at this wisdom is to think of it as the wisdom that understands dependent arising, how we're all interconnected and how things depend on other things. And Gosha, just like you were saying, you know, you change your attitude just with one thing of the worldly concerns, and you go off and then the entire class is different. So that's a dependent arising. And just having that happen and having that kind of flexibility already is a little liberation. So all phenomena arise by the collection of many conditions together. It's never just one thing. Because of the collection of many conditions, there is no inherence. So our very existence itself is a dependent arising. Who we are and how we feel about ourselves depends on how our family talks to us. Depends on if we have anyone to talk to or not. Often is dependent on how our family talked to us way back in the past. And everything can change with just a smile from a stranger. So just those so-called random events can have a profound effect on us. And yet we think this is me, like inherits the real me. And yet we can be tossed around by all of these different conditions that affect us. The other thing about inherence is that the way that we experience reality, the way we grasp at reality, however things first appear to us, we think it's true and real until kind of proven otherwise, and we get quite stuck like that. So if something appears pleasant, we kind of think it is really nice, truly nice, and then we're really shocked when it changes. Or if something appears unpleasant, we just think there's no hope for us. And yet things can change, as we've seen in the past year. So with this one also, we are a sum of the collection of our circumstances. So our education, our age, our health, doesn't that affect us? whether we have somewhere to live or not, and all of these things can change. And so then who we are changes as well. So when I first gave this course, it was to a bunch of postgraduate uni students, and one of the things that happens to uni students is that they have a thing called imposter syndrome, and it happens after you've been at uni for a few years. It's a well-established thing. They have counselling for it and everything, where if you're a postgrad and so you've got a little bit of status and you maybe aced your grades or whatever, but you still feel like a beginner. So you start feeling really guilty that everyone thinks I'm this and I'm not, and I'm going to be busted. I'm going to be found out. Everyone will know how stupid I really am and I don't know anything. So it's this incredible stress that comes along. But part of this comes because we grasp at all of those conditions as us, and they're unstable. And yes, we might be busted, but at the same time, you might get incredible marks and ace all your grades, but inside you don't feel strong. And so the result of that is imposter syndrome. Very debilitating. So what happens? We confuse the dual nature of reality. We confuse relative and ultimate. In fact, I think the way I understand this is we just flip them over. We get them completely back to front. So everything that we think is the real me is actually circumstantial. It's just a relative thing. And what we kind of think comes and goes is actually what we have in common with everybody. We have in common feelings and thoughts and a need to matter and to belong. And that's actually not just exclusive to us, that's what we have in common with everybody. So how we can actually use this training in wisdom straight away, regardless of what kind of philosophy that we get into, is by just remembering that things, and in particular problems, do not exist in the way they first appear. So by appear, I don't mean appear by your eyes, but how we first experience something. Even to notice that we're experiencing something is itself taking a step back from it. So like when COVID happened and the lockdown happened, none of us thought, oh, this is the appearance of lockdown. But it was an appearance. And how do we know? Because everybody experienced it differently. Some people loved it. Some people thrived. Some people renovated their houses. Some people got incredibly lonely. You know, some people went on holidays. Some people worked harder than they had in their whole life, like this huge array. And yet each one of us thought, this is how it is. So things actually don't exist in the way that they first appear. If we can remember that, that opens everything up. one of the other examples about this, for instance, is pain. So when we were talking last week about being averse to pain and wanting pleasant things. So pain, it's not pleasant, but it's very, very useful. It actually keeps us safe and protects us. Having something become painful protects us. So I've just been wearing in a pair of shoes, and I walked all around Carindale, and I came back and I hadn't realised, but I'd just worn the biggest blisters into my feet. And so then I wasn't able to wear shoes for 3 days afterwards because it didn't quite go down to the bone, but it was pretty graphic. And it's because I didn't notice as I was walking around. I was too involved in everything else. So it would have been much better if I actually had noticed that pain and gone, oh, I can't bear this, and just gone into a chemist and got a Band-Aid. But as it was, I got these really deep injuries in my foot. So this thing, how it first appears, pain appears bad, but it isn't. So questions or comments yet about this, just the beginnings of a higher training in wisdom? Too early yet? So let's have a look at cognitive fusion, which is part of this. So I've changed the notes to say, don't do cognitive fusion, which is something that Glenn Spencer has often said in his classes. It's like, hey, kids, don't do cognitive fusion. So what is cognitive fusion? It's fusing the behavior with the person. And, oh, my gosh, we just do it all the time. It's so habitual. Cognitive fusion, how it appears is how it is. There's a discrepancy, though. So one of them, you know, a person acting badly, it's only quite a well-trained person that will say, that is a person acting badly. Usually we go, that's a rude person, or that's a bad person, or a nasty person. So I thought I'd use an example of a child chucking a tantrum. So some people will say, that's just a bad child, they were born evil. And occasionally when a child does something really bad, people will say that. But most people won't, will they? So most people will say, no, that's just a child acting badly. A more compassionate person wouldn't even say that. They'd say, that is a child, you know, manifesting suffering, expressing suffering. So they see beyond the appearance. And actually, we can go even further than that. So instead of a child expressing suffering or expressing aversion, you could say, that is a potential Buddha screaming to be liberated. So that changes the appearance, doesn't it? It's a very difficult habit to break, but, you know, at least if we can see it in operation. So there's a couple of others that Corey Jackson talked about as well. So we've got a cognitive deficit and a cognitive hyperactivity. So a cognitive deficit is when in a difficult situation we cannot see any benefits. So then, you know, we can't change. And one of the classic ones is being frightened of the dentist. So that's where, when you think about going to the dentist, all that comes up is fear and aversion. And we can't imagine that going to the dentist will bring us relief from a toothache and possibly longevity. So that's when we completely fuse the bad experience and we think it is bad. And the only way that we ever get to the dentist is actually when the pain is so bad that we just want relief from the pain. And then we start thinking about the relief and then we go. But until we reach that point, people can put it off for years. Then there's another one, cognitive hyperactivity. So has anyone here ever had a hangover? I'll put up both my hands. No one's put up their hand. Oh, okay, thank you. Right, I can relax. So this is, having a hangover is a case of cognitive hyperactivity. So it's where in the pleasant situation, you overvalue all the enjoyable qualities. So you think about, glass of champagne, how very, very nice. Therefore, the second glass of champagne, twice as nice. Third glass of champagne, three times as nice. And then massive surprise the next morning. Now, how many times have I been surprised? So I count myself as a little educated. So how come, even though I know about this, it happened again and again and again, and it's because cognitive fusion has this grip on us. Another example about this cognitive hyperactivity is where I was watching this great show. It's an English show, Young, Dumb and Living Off Mum. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's quite amazing. These really devoted parents with their 25-year-old offspring still living at home. And so the offspring are quite spoiled and quite rude to their parents. And their parents are like, what can I do to help them? How are they ever going to, you know, survive in life? But actually what's happened is, as the parents have been growing up their children, they've done everything for them because of the need to be liked and to help, all of those immediate kind of things. And so that is a cognitive hyperactivity, thinking that being nice is a good thing to do, is the most important thing to do. But what happens is their kids end up basically being like social cripples, unable to care for themselves. They have to pretty much go from living at home to like living in a care home because don't know how to wash the dishes, don't know how to do their laundry, haven't made their bed, all of these things. So what appears to be devotion actually has incapacitated these young people. But that just comes from good-heartedness overwhelmed by cognitive hyperactivity, overestimating the importance of being nice, of appearing the friend. It can happen also in relationships where we keep peace. We keep peace with a partner that might be quite aggressive or violent or argumentative, and so we just keep the peace. And it does keep the peace, but the long-term consequences are really disastrous because it's, in a way, it's enabling destructive behavior. So cognitive fusion has a big hold on us. So what can we do? Some solutions. I'll tell you why I got a little picture of a house down the bottom as we get through it. There's a reason for it. So what we can do, just to get started, recognize the discrepancy between appearance and reality. So we even have to start looking for it and questioning our first kind of reactions to the world. Recognize cognitive fusion and have those words echoing in your head. Hey, kids, don't do cognitive fusion. And when it comes to wisdom, to work on your own mind first rather than abstract philosophy. So especially for Westerners, where we have such a wealth of information and quite educated, you know, compared to if you've never been to school, for instance. So we have a great liking of intellectual understanding, but that isn't changing your life. And this terrible thing can happen where you can intellectually understand more and more, but feel more and more miserable. And you go like, why? How come this is happening? That's because understanding is not enough. It's got to be like applied wisdom. Otherwise, we can know all about why we're depressed and why we're anxious and this and that and whatever, but it still hasn't helped us. So how we can do that is by thinking everything that we read and learn about. Every time, ask yourself, how does that apply to me? How can I apply that you know, this week in my life. And that'll keep us safe. Try and develop what's called the wisdom of selflessness. So that doesn't mean not being selfish. It means having no inherent self. So recognizing that who we are, it depends. Just having that in your mind. Who I am, what my identity is, it depends. So if you go and visit your oldies in an old people's home, they will say, "You young ones." If you go to a primary school, they'll think all of us are old except for you. You probably think all of us are old. So who we are, it depends. And so we have to keep remembering that. Then in terms of authentic teachings, or where we get our teachings or our information from, recognize that we live in what's called a post-truth world. So with everything that's available on the internet and, you know, anything that we don't like, we just call it fake news, and then as if that makes it disappear. There's William Burroughs' quote, "Nothing is true, everything is permitted." So that's what happens in a post-truth world where you have multiple, what do they call them, alternative facts. Then it means nothing is true, and then everything goes, anything goes. So it's a really dangerous place to be, and we are in that place because of the wealth of information that we have. And if we haven't just developed discriminating wisdom, we get in trouble. We start believing conspiracy theories and, you know, just whatever the first things that appear to us. So check your sources. Check your sources online, check your sources when you're reading self-help books. You know, has this book had a positive effect on people? Like, there was an amazing book came out 25, 30 years ago, maybe actually more, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Superb book, not a Buddhist book, but it radically changed people's lives for the better. So you can see it's got this amazing track record. So you can quote your sources, you can know where something comes from. Retrain your thinking and retrain your feeling. So this is why I put a picture of the little kitty's drawing of a house, because at first when we start reframing things, when we start thinking who I am, it depends, or how the reality appears, it depends. How we just start describing reality is very basic. And when we're studying philosophy or the nature of our existence or the nature of our mind, and we actually start trying to apply it to ourselves, we might think we're really at kindy now. It's really hard. So that's okay. It's like the first renderings of trying to draw a house. It's a bit crude. We miss out bits. I know when I first started drawing houses, my chimney always went off at an angle. It never went up straight up. But then as we become more familiar, that's it. It's just through familiarity. Then we can finesse it. Then we start getting confident. Then one day we can draw amazing architect drawings. And how we do that is using our words. So I've heard mummies say this to their kids when their kids are having difficulties. They say, now use your words, dear. And that is so profound. That's what we have to do. Use our words to remember there is no inherence. There is no real me. How things are depend. And that means they can change. So we train with these slogans, with words, and then that changes our whole experience of the world. It's all in the framing. So I'll tell you a little story about this. Quite a few years ago now, when Venerable Rabina came and gave a talk here, and it might have been a talk on karma. I think it was, why do bad things happen to good people? And this family came along, and so it was mother and a father and a couple of siblings and a young man who was about 18 or 19 in a wheelchair. And they came along because they wanted to figure out why he broke his back. So he had some diving accident, and it was, you know, only like, you know, a few months beforehand. And he was just universally loved in his school, and he was a really good athlete and all of these things. And so how come something like that happened to such a good person? So Venerable Robina gave a talk about karma. Any questions? Straight up goes the hand. Why did I break my back? You know, why did this happen? And the mother was asking, you know, such a beautiful son, why did this have to happen to him? And so Venerable Robina, she was so skillful. She said, what about all the good things that happened to him? Do we ever ask, why am I born into such a caring family? Why am I born with universal health care? How come the Ambos were able to be there within 5 minutes? Like, we don't question those good things. We just go, why did this terrible thing happen to me? So just in the framing of just asking one extra question. So she was kind of saying, of course, this is a terrible thing to happen. No one would wish it on anybody, but in terms of having it happen in Australia and all the incredible people that came and helped at the time, and how fortunate he felt that he had that kind of help and in this amazing supportive family, it could have been so much worse, and yet it wasn't. So, you know, because he was such a good person, all of these good circumstances ripened as well as the horrible one. So what was amazing, like it's like a weight just lifted from them. Instead of thinking, oh, this was some punishment for the poor kid and he didn't deserve it, they just went, oh, and left. And that's the only time we ever saw them, but they were completely relieved. So that's the thing, just in the reframing, just asking a different question. Okay, so any questions about wisdom? Is that enough to get going with? Comments? You're already done in. It's a lot, it is. That's why I thought I'd start on the hard one. Okay, so then the next one, the higher training and concentration. So what is concentration? It's a lot more than just kind of being absorbed in something. So it's a mental factor. It's a mental factor of being able to abide one-pointedly on an object of virtue without distraction. So to be able to pick an object of virtue and focus on it, you know, at will, for as long as you want, in whatever manner you want, totally relaxed, no distractions. So we can kind of get an idea of, wow, to be able to focus that nicely. But part of concentration, or the higher training concentration, is to focus on an object of virtue. So what an object of virtue is in Buddhism, the dragon roar of wisdom just coming at us right there. What an object of virtue is anything that brings happiness, anything that brings peace of mind, anything like love, compassion, kindness. So we can't separate out those virtuous qualities from concentration, because a hitman or a cat burglar might have really good concentration, but that's not the higher training in concentration. And actually in war, you know, people can have hyper focus like that, but it's not the higher training, because higher training in concentration has to be focused on something that's going to bring long-term peace and happiness. So it engenders all the other good qualities. It benefits us, it benefits others. It's always informed by ethics, virtue, wisdom of interdependence. So if we have concentration, it has these amazing effects on us. If we can concentrate and develop this higher training, it results in what's called mental and physical pliancy. So it means that our mind can become very relaxed and open. And whatever we want to focus on, we just go, oh, I'm going to focus on this now. I'm going to read this, and we can read it. We can understand it. Wow. Instead of like, oh, God, I really got to focus on this thing. And my mind's like, whoa, worried about this and that and can't seem to settle. Like, we all know that one, don't we? But imagine being able to be relaxed and alert. And then place your mind on something that's going to bring real sustenance to your heart, and then be able to focus on that and then remember it all afterwards. So that's mental pliancy. And then, of course, our physical state is affected too. Our body's relaxed. You know, how much tension do we hold in our body? How much do we have pain in our neck or all of these things? And people grind their teeth when they're asleep and all of that. So if we had concentration, all of that would fall away. The only way that we can develop concentration is if our ethics are good, though, because if we're not comfortable in our own skin, if our conscience isn't sitting well, if we're worried about something, we're not going to be able to concentrate. So Yangtze Rinpoche, in this great book, Practicing the Path, so there's a really good section here on the three high trainings from page 249. So I got a lot of information out of that book. And he kind of said that usually our minds are like cities of distractions, giving rise to countless superstitions, countless conceptual thoughts. Being able to calm this and focus on virtuous objects is the basis for cultivating realizations. Without being to calm this, it's just going to be intellectual and we're still going to suffer. We're still going to be miserable. So we need to be able to develop concentration so that we can discriminate good from bad, so we can figure out what to do. Instead of panic, like, what do I do here? To be able to actually focus and sort it out. What do I do? How's it going to benefit? How's it going to harm? Make an informed decision. So, before I go there, the other thing too, there is a difference between being able to concentrate and something called attention capture. So many times, especially because we've got so much media that we get involved in, I know I can watch television for hours undistractedly. I can binge watch for hours undistractedly, but that's not concentration. Playing video games for hours and being 100% into it also isn't concentration. That's attention capture. So our attention is captured from something outside. There is no effort on our part really to focus. Whereas when we sit down and try and actually focus on something without relying on our senses, without writing anything down, without looking at anything, without reading anything, just using our mind, it's really hard. You know, even when we just sat down to start the class, just to focus on the breath, which is actually, you know, a physical thing, but it's still really difficult because our breath doesn't capture our attention. So because so much of what we get involved in is actually attention capture, we might think we might be able to focus and concentrate on things, but actually one day when we have to sit there and really think something through, we find ourselves just exhausted and unable to do it. So, what can we do? Solutions. How to get started. So, one of the things to do is to try and make sure that we have a bit of what's called physical solitude. give ourselves some space. So physically, in our environment, being free of social media, free of distractions from pets. Like, how many times have I sat down to meditate and then it's, oh, there's the pussycat. Or free of lists, sit down to do something and go, oh, yeah, I must remember to do blah, blah, blah. So I write a list. And then whether you write the list, it keeps on going. Or if you don't write the list, then you think about it in your head. But this compulsion for lists. And actually, even on meditation retreats, when you do start focusing, then the lists just get better quality. They become very alluring. It's like, no, this is a really important list to write down. So all of these things, they capture our attention. And also to be free of those really big distractors, alcohol, drugs, sitting down to meditate, having had a good strong coffee is probably not a good idea. It's probably better to have a snooze and then wake up refreshed and then do some practice. Being able to find some physical solitude from all those things that trigger us, that make us unhappy, that really make us annoyed. As beginners, we've got to have a nice safe space like that so we get a feeling of what it's like. But those safe spaces don't come by themselves. We have to kind of carve them out for us. Then mental solitude. So that means being free of rumination. So distancing yourself from objects of lust or hatred within your mind. Because just removing ourselves physically from situations that are that trigger us or that have a bad effect on us isn't enough, because we can't control our circumstances like that, and there's always going to be an annoying person. So for that, then we've got to figure out how to find that space within our mind, within our heart. Many times we think the problem is finished. If the annoying person is gone, then we go, great, the problem is solved. But it's just a holding pattern, isn't it, until the next annoying person comes along. So actually, in that space of mental solitude, when the annoying person has gone away, that's the time to do some inner work and to get some fortitude and some patience. So the next time an annoying person comes along, you're not as distressed. So one way we can do this is when we have this urge for a holiday. Has anyone here wanted to take a holiday? Has anyone here managed to take a holiday ever? No, Lynn. Not in living memory. So that urge for a holiday, that need to have a holiday, is actually a need to have this mental solitude. And so often what happens, we manage to go on holiday, we have a bit of a break. We manage to have some physical solitude from social media or from going to work or all of those, you know, things that pressure us. So we spend the first few days sleeping, pay a lot of money to sleep in a hotel or something like that. But then with that holiday, then we become maybe physically rejuvenated, maybe we give our mind a bit of a break, but that's usually where we leave it. And then we go back into the world, back into the fray again. And that's why we have to keep on having holidays. It's not like, oh, I had a holiday, I'm fine now, forever. So actually what we want to do is add something to that holiday so that you actually rest, you become rejuvenated. And then when you're in this optimal frame of mind and you're not tired, that's when you actually start doing the inner work, start the study, start focusing. Not when you're tired, not when you're in the midst of the problem that's overwhelming you and you can barely keep your head above water. It's actually when you've got this optimum space. But when we have that, We hardly ever do it. So Lama Tso Rinpoche says, the real holiday is the mind free of delusion. And I know you can combine the two. You can have a holiday. And I know I've raised a few eyebrows down in Bendigo when we have the retreats with Lama Tso Rinpoche, because I spend the morning in my pajamas and my dressing gown. I have an array of spectacular dressing gowns. And I just figured I just have to sleep in on retreat. And then I can stay up all night and listen to the teachings and I'm completely there and I'm not tired and I can focus. But to keep my mind happy, one, I don't help doing organizing anything, and two, I sleep in. So while everyone's coming back from their first meditation session or whatever, I'm waltzing off to the loo in my spectacular flamingo dressing gown and everyone's like, whoa, what's Miffy been doing? It's like, I'm on holiday. This retreat is a holiday. So I'm resting and I'm kicking back and I'm also going to the meditation sessions and the teachings, just not the morning ones. And so what I've noticed is I can do a retreat like that for 6-8 weeks and be completely rejuvenated at the end of it. And other people are a wreck at the end of it because they've been sleep deprived and they've been trying to be really good students and go to everything and meditate really, really hard, and then they start getting really cranky. It's like, you don't do the offering bowls like that. So is something missing here? So it's okay. You can mix the holiday, the outer holiday, to get the inner holiday. Anyway, if you all start showing up for a retreat in spectacular dressing gowns, clearly I'm going to have a lot to answer for. So then attention is the other thing. What to place our attention on. Choose an object of meditation and focus your mind on it. So it is good to actually have an object of meditation that's an inner object. For beginners, perhaps having music in the background or having a nice view or a candle flame or a nice picture, that's a good start, but that's a preliminary. That shouldn't be the main focus, because our senses are going outwards all the time anyway. So what we're actually trying to do is draw our attention inwards. So an inner object is better. So a midway point is something like focusing on the breath, because it's kind of inner, even though it's senses, but it draws our focus inwards. And the benefit of that is if you lose your focus, doesn't matter, you still keep breathing. But focusing on a meditation on loving kindness, on developing compassion and patience, on the qualities of a Buddha. So you can have an image of a Buddha and then, you know, look at the image and then close your eyes and then think about those qualities that that image represents. So it becomes an inner experience. Try and avoid the two things, laxity and excitement. So try not to fall asleep is one. And actually Glenn Svensson said a really useful thing, that even if you meditate or you think best lying down, like sitting on the couch outside or sitting on a bus are probably the two places that I do my best thinking. But to not associate where you do your thinking or your reflection with the same place of where you go to sleep, because the two will get associated. And I started thinking, just about all of us grew up with reading ourselves to sleep, didn't we? Talk about terrible associations. We want to read ourselves awake, not read ourselves to sleep. So to avoid the laxity of getting so relaxed that you just fall asleep, try and have that experience of being relaxed, but your mind really alert and open. And so Glenn also gave this great advice that if you do find yourself getting sleepy, then go, I'm going to put my reflection aside now and have a nap. So you make a demarcation. And then you won't set up the association of every time you sit down and meditate, you fall asleep. And avoiding excitement as well, all the distractions. So you sit down and then you just start daydreaming. And daydreaming is very alluring. So, again, set a time to do daydreaming and then have a time where you're actually going to focus on what you want to focus on and just make a demarcation. And in terms of any kind of focus or meditation, the thing is, don't make it longer and longer and longer. Make the quality better. Still keep it a short session, a short practice, but just the quality gets better. So that you get so skilled at being able to focus that, say, someone comes along and they gives you instructions how to do something, you can just read them and remember them and off you go. That whenever you want to, you can focus your mind and hold that information. So that just comes from being able to sit down, you kind of get a habit. The place where you sit, you get set up and you focus your mind and you're not kind of caught in the allure of daydreams and you're not really tired and falling asleep and you just focus. And that time can get shorter and shorter and shorter till within a few seconds you can be there and focused. So I noticed with me coming to teachings, it takes me a good 10 minutes to get focused on what the Lama is talking about. Most of the time I feel like my mind is like ice skating. You know, I can hear the words, but I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm just kind of skidding all over everything. So it takes me a while to be able to just go right into, that's what they're talking about, to penetrate that with that focus. Question, Lynn, or you just... Yeah. Oh, okay. and I've also noticed, say, with just fixing the website and things, that if I'm focused, I can kind of dive into what's happening and figure it out. And if I'm not, I can look at a page and I go, I have no idea what's going on. And it's just from not being able to focus. So we really need to practice. And how to practice is to keep that short, say, 15-minute session and just make it more skilled, more focused, better quality. Then you can kind of easily settle. So that's this skill. It's a training, concentration. We need it, like we need fitness. Like we need fitness to get about our life, we need to have this mental fitness. But it's a concentration on all of the things that will engender our good qualities. Which leads us to higher training in ethics. The third thing that we need to become a good human being. So ethical conduct, being ethical means that we actually restrain ourselves from harm. We restrain ourselves from harming others or harming ourselves. And we actually want to restrain ourselves from harm. So ethics is all about physical and verbal actions, how we act, how we communicate. What's going on in our mind, that's anybody's guess. But the ethics part is how we're out in the world, the being embodied. The higher training in ethics has the motivation that isn't just an ordinary kind of worldly one. Say you want to appear like a good ethical person for status or to impress somebody or to get a gold star or to get the promotion. The actual purpose is to become completely free of psychic existence, to be able to perfectly help others. So this is actually a way, a really direct way of being able to keep our ethics pure and not just be a show of ethics, is to remember, why are we wanting to be ethical? So Nagarjuna says, ethics is the very foundation of all the qualities that we develop within ourselves. If a container is broken, how can it hold anything? If our ethics are broken, how can we develop positive qualities? Ethics is about embodying your values, not having a double standard. So that's kind of like, if we don't have good ethics, then even good things that we do are tarnished. So just recently, you know, in the news, if politicians and staffers didn't rape their staff, you know, it doesn't matter what good those politicians do, the fact that they've raped their staff tarnishes everything. We wouldn't want them in our house. You know, and many times people will try and throw money after it, and often the person who's been harmed goes, I don't want your money. They don't even want that money. They may even be poor, but they don't want that money because that negativity, it tarnishes everything. So if we want to keep what we do, the things that matter to us and that we put effort into, if we want to keep it untarnished, we've got to have our ethics be really pure. So the ways that we often have our ethics is by having an external witness. So often we act well when there are other people around. You know, but when we're at home, we're just a real slob. Then someone's coming over and we clean the house. So there was this study that they did in the shops, that if they put a mannequin at the front door of the shop, people are way less likely to shoplift because they feel as they walk into the shop that they're being watched subliminally. So whether it's a mannequin, whether it's a cutout cardboard cutout of a, you know, life-size cutout, that's why they have them at the front. It's to deter shoplifters. Because subliminally we go, oh, I'm being watched, and so then you're very, very good. They did that experiment over the at work where you have the honours box of buying the chocolates. And so they had 1 week they had just the chocolates there in the jar, and so by the end of the week it was mostly IOUs in the jar. No one put any money in. So then the next week they had the chocolates and they had a picture of a smiling face of a lady saying thank you. And pretty much as like 95% of those chocolates were paid for, the money was in the jar. So then they started thinking, well, how far can we push it? So they just put a smiley face the next week, same amount of chocolates, 95% of the chocolates paid for with just a smiley face. Then they thought, oh, well, let's just get rid of the face altogether, and they just put cartoon eyes, just pair of eyes, and that was enough. So all of these subliminals, most of how we act is dependent on having a witness of being watched. So if there is no witness, then we act really badly. That's why people say all that horrible stuff online, because there's no direct witness there. It's just going off into the void. So we want to actually have our ethics come from within, not because we're bargaining with karma, not because we think we should, not because we're worried about what other people will think of us, reputation, not out of fear, not out of guilt, but actually out of wisdom, understanding the difference between right and wrong. And that way we won't second guess ourselves. We won't doubt ourselves. If things go wrong, we won't have a crisis of conscience. We'll know we did our best. We figured it out. We know what we did was the very best that we possibly could. And even if everyone rises up against us, it won't shake us. So some of the worldly ways that we actually have vows, for instance, we have marriage vows. Scouts vows, citizenship vows, citizenship ceremonies, like their vows, their secular ones. In Buddhism, we have, you know, vows of refuge, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows. You hold those vows, they help you. They hold you back from acting negatively. And at first, when you hold those vows, you've got to remember that you have them, and then after a while, they become second nature. Having a professional code of conduct, that's something that we all expect of people, and that can be a really big ask. So if you have a teacher at school, you expect that teacher to treat everybody in the class with equal care and concern, regardless of whether they get on or not. And in a hospital and at a doctor's, we expect the doctor to treat us whether they like us or not, whether we're sick and rude or whether we're a really polite patient. So this professional code of conduct, Lama Zorro Rinpoche says, what we have to do is become inner professionals. So that means we can develop a sense of equanimity, that no matter how people, what they appear, whether they show an angry face or a rude face or a kind face, we treat everyone with equal kindness. So that's being an inner professional. So we can do that. We've got a really well-honed sense of professionalism. We take that into our spiritual life. So I'll tell you a slightly risque story. When I first came to Lungri Tumpa Center, and so I was trying to turn my life around, and here I am in a center where I really should appear to be a good person, but, you know, I had a bit of a case of imposter syndrome. And so I was talking with a couple of friends, and they were saying, oh, you know, I mean, I'm so happy to have met the Dharma, to have met the Buddha's teachings, but in a way it's made my life really difficult, because now life, it'd be so much easier if I could just sell dope, you know, because back in the day it was so much easier and I had enough money to live on and everything, and now it's this really big struggle and I can't do it. And actually a life of crime is so much easier for a little while until you get caught. But that allure of it, what holds you back is this sense being an inner professional. So when I go up to Carindale Shops, now the ladies, the checkout chicks, they know I come from the Buddhist center. So there is no way I can ever have a bad day. There is no way I can be cranky. In fact, I've got to be very, very good all the time, because there's a reputation of Lungri Tumpa Center. So because it all started, I'd buy all of the puja offerings, and so sometimes for the big celebrations, I'd have a couple of trolleys of chocolates, soy milk and bananas. And they just look at me and go, like, what kind of diet are you on? And the kiddies would look at me going, wow, what are you doing? It's like, and then they find out I'm a Buddhist, and then the kiddies are going, I want to be a Buddhist. And the checkout chicks, okay, that's that lady with the pink hair who buys all the chocolates for the Buddhist center. So now I have to be really, 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 really nice all the time, like absolutely, otherwise I'll bring the whole of Buddhism into disrepute, isn't it? Just takes one person to bring it into disrepute. And so, yeah, we've got to abide by the laws of the land. Even if, you know, you think marijuana is a fine thing and a medicinal thing, if it's illegal and you make your money that way, you're going to be in really big trouble. And can you imagine if the Buddhists get busted selling marijuana? I mean, you'd never come back from that, would you? So we have our professional code of conduct, and our ethics makes sure that everything that we do is kept clean, that it's like having that bowl, that it holds what we have clean and precious. If we have good ethics, it means whatever we study, it will benefit us and we won't become unhinged. So many people study too hard and get really unhinged, get separated from reality, kind of, you know, out of step, very intellectual, but quite oblivious to the pain of others. But if you have ethics and you actually embody it, then whatever you study, it's going to actually enhance your life, your heart. And in a time where ethics is an optional extra, actually focusing on this and putting some effort into it is really powerful because it's going against the grain. So how to act? We've got when with others, when in company, watch your physical actions and your speech. And when you're alone, watch your mind. So instead of friends with benefits, try and cultivate friends with ethics. Make sure you have friends with ethics. Make sure that there are people you spend time with that are better people than you, so that you can go into their slipstream and be carried along by them. If you are the most ethical person that you know and you're carrying everyone along with you, that's not enough. You've got to actually be in an environment where you get lifted up and where people don't think you're weird for being ethical. People don't think you're weird for not cheating on your taxes, you know, or gullible or something like that. Become active in civil society. So, you know, if we're not part of the solution, we're part of the problem. So actually being active, contributing in some way, you know, that level of happiness of what we bring to the world, contributing is infinitely better than just agreeing. If we have a sense of humility and we respect others, it turns out much better for us, actually. So this centre, Lungri Tungpa Centre, is named after Geshe Lungri Tungpa, and he wrote 8 verses for training the mind, for transforming our mind. So a really short teaching on the path to enlightenment, 8 short verses. And so one of them was to always see oneself the lowest of all. And so what that does is it keeps our ethics pure. So if you have, I know that I can't remember what country it is now, but one of the South American countries where the president there, he didn't live in a huge presidential castle. He just lived in the same house and he just drove an old bomb, little VW, and he gave most of his salary to the poor, because he didn't see himself as better. He saw himself as lower than his constituents. And so then naturally everything else flowed from that. And he was incorruptible. He couldn't be bribed. So if all the politicians saw themselves as servants, as lower than others, they would be incorruptible. We wouldn't have bribery. We wouldn't have scandals. It only comes from seeing yourself as higher than others. So in terms of keeping our ethics pure and making sure we uphold these values that you know, we hold dear, it actually comes from having trying to develop this sense of humility and respecting others. Then, of course, we won't harm them. Okay, then when we're on one's own, practice good mental hygiene. This is another quote from Corey Jackson. So that means when we're by ourselves, careful, look after your mind. When you find yourself going off on a negative track, careful, be kind, change the channel, go and do something else. Don't let yourself ruminate. Proudly uphold your code of conduct, whatever code of conduct it is, whether you're a parent, a teacher, a carer, you know, those codes of conduct, actually, they're like a cloak of superpowers. So that's why I put this, instead of like Thousand Arm Chenrezig, a superpower lady with a cloak. So the cloak is that code of conduct. So we personally mightn't feel like we can do it, but we put on our code of conduct and we can. We embody it. Becoming the inner professional, we talked about that already. Avoiding spiritual materialism. So that's in terms of ethics, it's to develop our sense of ethics, not motivated by status, not motivated by wanting everybody else to think we're a good student or a good person. Not motivated by wanting to please our parents or our boss, looking favorably, by our teacher. So all of that's that kind of, it's a materialistic way of approaching it. So instead of worrying about one's status or one's reputation, remember, why do we have ethics? To develop happiness, to have a safe environment, to help ourselves and to help others, for liberation, enlightenment. And so part of ethics, having a concentration to focus on virtue, happiness is a habit. Often we forget, we think happiness is something that'll happen to us or something that we can get. But remember, happiness is a practice. So instead of practicing anxiety, worry or resentment, practicing happiness. And that is based on ethics. So you can see these three higher trainings, of course, they'll make our life better right now. But their main purpose is the really big picture, the cessation of suffering altogether. So we've got ethics, the foundation, the strong body. So you just think, I'm going to embody my ethics. The two arms, we've got to concentrate or we're going to have an accident with the axe. So developing our concentration. And a real incentive for this is that our concentration is informed by love, by kindness, not stress. And the wisdom that cuts the root of ignorance, the cause of all suffering. So tell me, can you see how they all fit together, the three, how they support each other? Questions, comments? You're a very quiet group, aren't you? It's been 3 weeks now. Surely there's a question or a comment. Yes. I think when other people act ethically to acknowledge that. So if someone stands up to bullying or if someone does the right thing that you acknowledge the virtue, I think that's important because so much negativity is there's focus brought to you, and when people act well, it's just often ignored. So definitely encourage virtue, and if people are really struggling, encourage them in their best self, you know, that they have this potential and they can live up to it and you're there to support them. In terms of kind of trying to tell people about ethics, we have to be really careful about that because what we say, it's like, as any parent will know, what you say doesn't make an iota of difference. It's how you act. So you can say, but you actually have to act it first. So that's why ethics is the body. You have to act it out. And then if you put words to it, people will believe you and have confidence in you. But if you just, like a politician, go, oh, yes, we care about society and ascribe to this professional code of conduct, and you look what they do, doesn't have any effect. It just makes us jaded and cynical. So it's quite a tricky thing. But the lamas always say, wherever you see people acting well and acting virtuously, to encourage them. So, you know, I saw what you did there. You know, you're so patient. And I appreciate the effort that went into it, and good on you. So, I mean, you know, from our side, we shouldn't do things for the praise or the acknowledgement. If we get stuck on the acknowledgement, it kind of goes into that success and failure and whatever. But that's quite different from actually showing encouragement to people. It's important. And we respond well to encouragement, much more than to the wagging finger, isn't it? And, I mean, so Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, who founded this centre, Lama Yeshe was so encouraging of everybody. Everyone felt happy in his teachings, and it's because he taught to your best self. He absolutely had confidence that you could do it, and he taught to your Buddha nature, basically. And so you just felt yourself sitting there going, oh, yeah, I can do it. It was so incredible. So, you know, that's what I found helps me, that kind of encouragement. So just before we dedicate, next week, homework, if you have the notes, there are three higher reflections. So I don't think there's actual questions. There's reflections to do with the three higher trainings. And just to generally think about, wow, the superpower cloak of becoming an inner professional. How are we going to do that? What kind of superpower are you going to have this week? next week we're going to look at the hidden wisdom in anxiety and depression. So it's just past 8. We can dedicate the merits. So to bring it to a conclusion, you can think, just by coming along today, you know, you're trying to be good human beings, focusing on objects of virtue, you know, thoughts and concepts that will bring long-term happiness for yourself and others. And you put the effort into concentrating. And no doubt there's been some light bulb moments, and you've been putting it together and things are slotting into place. So that kind of wisdom cuts away the delusion. So we can dedicate all of that effort that we may be able to train to become this good human being, to bring the utmost benefit to ourselves and others, to be able to liberate ourselves from cyclic existence, and even to become a fully awakened Buddha so we can perfectly help others. Starting right here this week with the three higher trainings. So, Anne, questions, comments, go for it.
I'm getting my Doctor Who Jodie Whittaker doll out for my superpower.
Yes.
I'll have it here next week. but more seriously, yeah, look, it was another really good session. I really liked the section on ethics. I mean, the others too, but ethics probably coming from the professional background, because we had code of conduct. I was a trainer. I had to train people in code of conduct. Mm-hmm. Being a trainer in code of conduct, I had to conduct myself well. And I remember when I first went to the level of having a small team, I was a team leader, and it was in a different context, it was in rehab programs. But I think she was a cheeky one, but one of the team came to me and said, oh, I've heard you're a straight. And I didn't even kind of connect what she was talking about. She meant that I'm a stickler for kind of doing things by the book. And it took me a while to kind of process it, and then I thought, I don't even know why that came out into the air, and I don't know what I meant to do with it. But I thought, thank goodness. Somewhere in me I went, thank goodness, and I thought I could just flip it around and say, yeah, probably not as much as you've heard, you know. But I thought, no, I'm just going to stick with that and be kind of nonplussed about it. But the other thing too about code of conduct was I felt the lack of it not working anymore.
So that's that thing of having your code of conduct come from outside of you, relying on it.
But it was interesting doing the volunteer program because there's a code of conduct, and I found that very comforting. But with the Langui Tang percent of volunteer, you're starting to internalize that it's becoming a spiritual code of conduct. And it was really nice how that, as you were going through all that, those things were just coming in, and I went, well, it's like I'm coming home again. It was really,
And I mean, we can use the power of needing a code of conduct. I mean, that's why there are bodhisattva vows. That's why they're there, because vows actually have a power to help us. And so we, the witness, you know, are the bodhisattvas. So we use the power of having a witness, but as you said, it's bringing it more internalized, and why we practice the ethics becomes far more deep. It's not just because mum or dad said so, or because we'll be busted by the police, but now it's, you know, for bodhicitta, for the benefit of others, and that's a motivator. So it's quite different, that code of conduct. And a bodhisattva code of conduct, for instance, you could practice even if you never saw a living being, because it's there in your heart.
That's right. Yeah, and that's like the refuge vows that I took. They are like a guiding light. And but because it was in a different context, I guess what I'm trying to say here is this all married it up, where it's not this or that. This is a whole of thing. Yeah.
Great.
It's great.
Oh, Anne, that's really nice to hear. I'm very glad you saw the coherence of it.
Yes.
Now, John, do you have anything? Okay, so a little bit of a quip there. Okay, it feels like you're talking about stripping away societal programming to get people back to original Buddha nature. Yeah, well, societal programming is where we start, but it isn't enough. In fact, we start with, you know, with our parents, and then we have the societal programming. But as we know, I mean, if you've ever read that book, Lord of the Flies, you know, what happens when societal programming is no longer there? Then does everyone go crazy? Or have people internalize their ethics? So, you know, many times if nobody's watching, you just get away with whatever you can. Bruce, I can do all these for you. So does evil come from society or nature? Evil, from a Buddhist point of view, does not have any inherence. Evil is a mistake. So it's when we have a mistaken or distorted view, a distorted way of relating, distorted assumptions. So even murderers, violent people, from the point of view of from where they're coming from, it makes sense to them. So the result harms others. It's out of step with reality, but from their point of view, it makes sense. So in a way, everybody's trying to do the best they can. They're trying to do what makes them happy. And some people are laboring under huge misconceptions. So what they do harms others, or what they do harms themselves. So many materialists, for instance, will just take from the environment whatever you can and dump the rubbish. So we might think of that's evil, but actually that just comes from not understanding reality. And now later on, after how many decades of capitalism and extractive this and extractive that, now we get pollution in the environment and climate change, and we get the result. So you could never say that was evil. You just say you're laboring under a mistake, and that creates suffering. It is tempting to say some people are evil, but I personally think when we label something evil, it's a psychological armor that we're putting up, where we're trying to make ourselves separate from the evil. We're trying to put up a barrier, as if to say it's not me, they're evil, or that's evil, or society has an evil nature or something, whereas actually we're kind of involved in it, but also we can change. Do you have anything to add to that one, Anne, about evil?
I think that the little bit I've learned in the lot of Buddhist study I've done, because I say it's little, but I really get the feeling that the words like evil and guilt, it's not that they're unknown, but they're not taken on in Dharma world in the same way as, say, in the Christian religious world. And it's not saying that there's no such thing as inappropriate behavior or bad behavior. It's just, it's really looking at it in a whole karmic thing, in a whole samsara. It's really quite different. And it is really hard when you've had many years of being in a world that defines things with evil and good and the rest of it. It's really hard to step out of that and see there's no existence, it's empty. That's one of the biggest challenges, I think. So I'm still working on it.
There's a couple of approaches to that, Anne, too, because when we do relate to something that's really evil, like John's saying about someone irredeemable or someone who is so brutalized that they cannot recover in this lifetime. So for that, our society might call them evil, but actually that's cognitive fusion. So what's happened is they are overwhelmed by their negativities, but they are not their negativities. So they may be completely brutalized, but that is not them. So that kind of gives us a little bit of a room to move. It may not be this life. It may have to be, you know, this life may be ruined and the person may have no way of actually communicating anymore. From our side, though, so Hannah Arendt, the great Jewish philosopher, you know, she said actually evil, when we look at it, is banal evil. So it's kind of that where how evil functions is through ignorance, through apathy, through good people doing nothing, just the ordinariness that creeps in. Banal evil is actually the most destructive one. Some really aggressive super force is actually easier to deal with. That's right. So John, you're talking about the character with a garland of fingers that Buddha helped, Angulimala. That's right. So he was operating from a place where he thought he wanted to be liberated, and he was willing to do anything. And so he had he took a teacher, a guru, without checking him out, and he did what his guru told him. And his guru said, kill 1,000 people and you'll be free. So that's, I mean, whether we think of that as a parable, there's many people that have thought, you know, I'll decimate a country, I'll get all of this, and then I'll be free, then I'll be happy. And it's putting your eggs in a basket where it's not possible. It's a mistaken, distorted view, and then it brings this untold suffering. So, yeah, I wonder about Angulimala. I probably would have responded pretty badly to someone like that. But the Buddha did not have cognitive fusion.
You know,
he didn't mix up Angulimala's behavior with that potential Buddha right there. And that really shows us there is a middle way, because also we're not being an apologist for Angulimala. We're not saying, oh, he was actually a nice guy. No, he was terrifying. He was a mass murderer. So actually when we can recognize cognitive fusion, then we can really see what's going on, and we can accurately read a situation and go, that is a mass murderer and I'm getting out of here, without falling into hatred.
It's about having that that wisdom in the right direction, like in the right space, and not kind of, getting it all conflated and mixed up. I really did like those examples, like the bad child and, you know, or is it a suffering child? Because, again, because of my training, it was always not labelling and not doing. You worked with what exactly is going on for people, or if people had done bad stuff, you're not all of that. As a person, you're not all the bad acts you've done, you know. You are... And the part, even when I had to work with some pretty heavy stuff, I'd always go in thinking they're not all of that. And that was often how we'd start our sessions, was drawing a big circle and all the components that everyone's made up of, and just saying, well, you know, that's that bit.
That's that bit.
But
yes, someone told me, Anne, too, that in, like, with counselling and things, that you have an attitude called assumed positive regard.
Absolutely.
Now that is like being an inner professional. If we have assumed positive regard with everybody, it's like we're on their side, and all of their delusions and everything, that's what's overwhelming them, but we're friends. We're you know, kind, and we're on their side.
Yeah.
And you can have assumed positive regard also with wild animals and with snakes and whatever, without actually being, underestimating their danger, because you still know, oh, yeah, the poisonous snake wants to be safe.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't necessarily invite someone who is in a highly deluded state to pop home with you and have a coffee. You might go, well, go to a coffee shop, you know. But you're being present with them for the part of them that's present in that moment. And, yeah, it takes a lot of training, and it takes a lot of head shift.
The lamas have that, you know, when we
have
teachings and you know, Geshe Zopa and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, they have a natural assumed positive regard for everybody there, a natural kindness, naturally wanting to help. And if someone's, you know, really distressed or really rude or really whatever, it doesn't faze them. They still care about them, and that's what I find mind-blowing.
They're unflinching. They're unflinching. They're almost like a statue there, and the, you know, everything else. Yeah. I could never be that, but I had those moments where it was just the rest fell away. It was quite interesting. And I'm, you know, the other thing you talked about, like I've said a few times, I'm losing my vision, but I wrote down, well, ask why I've had such a rich life. Why have I enjoyed such a good career? And I went, yeah, you know, I don't say that enough. I'm sitting here moaning about stuff, you know. So,
I mean, because you're one of the inspirations of why, you know, we keep the online classes, for instance. So, you know, there's the losing the vision, but then there's all the other fortunate things around it.
Yes.
And so you've created the merit for that, to have that support in amongst the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel very blessed. It's and I feel that that's going to have an enormous flow on too. Like, yeah. This is, you know, this isn't just about me. Yeah.
No, that's right. So, you can go through that experience for others, you know, and then help others who don't have the fortitude and don't have the support that you do.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, John said about judge their behavior, not them. And that's it. That's like the mantra that we've got to. And so my test to myself is when I look at a politician and I go, so Miffy, how much are you judging their behaviour and how much are you judging them? And I have to, like, really pull myself up.
yes, that's right.
Then my
litmus
test, how am I going? And it takes a bit of talking myself through it, but you can get there. Yeah.
Yeah, I found it very helpful in the times of COVID, no matter who they were, no matter what side they were on, no matter how little social justice they had in their little toolkit, I'd go, you are awesome for showing up today. You know, like, these times are tough. You're in front of the camera and you're doing it. Like, that's whoever they were, whichever state or federally, it was like, you're here and you're present and you're answering questions, you must be exhausted. So that was a great leveler, you know. And I thought, well, I need to carry those thoughts going forward and not slip back into, you're on the wrong side, or you don't.
Yeah, or even like if we don't use the person with their behaviour, we can actually call out the bad behaviour. Because we can say, you're better than that. You're better than that behaviour. How can you do that and keep your self-respect?
That's right, yeah.
So I don't watch TV. John doesn't watch TV, that's how I keep my sanity.
I just binge Netflix. Guilty.
Yeah. You know, we all have our coping or not coping mechanisms, don't we?
Yeah, but it's a good way, definitely. You see a lot of wild and wacky stuff going on.
So it's just on 8:30 now. So thank you, Anne, and thank you, John, for staying back. I wish I could figure out how to see the chat whilst I'm leading the class, but it's beyond me at the moment. Maybe as we get through the year, I'll learn. But as long as you're okay staying back and having a chat like
perfectly.
This. I don't forget that you're there. It's just so
no,
thank
it's perfectly
you so much.
Fine.
And thank you for being so attentive. It's really warms my heart. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miffy. Goodbye, John.
See you next week.
See you.
Bye-bye.
See you.